Welcome to Terrace Talk with Sir Fogarty with you, and as this is a pre-recorded programme, no phone lines open tonight. Well, 5 months ago, in a blaze of media publicity, a new manager was appointed to the Republic of Ireland soccer team, following in the footsteps of names like Owen Hand, Alan Kelly, Johnny Giles, Jack Charlton and Mick McCarthy. A magnificent start to his new manager's career, 5 wins and a draw, and Ireland back in contention for a place in the European finals. I'm delighted to have as my special guest tonight, Brian Kerr. Brian, you're very welcome to Kerry and very welcome to Terrace Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm sorry I can't get here more often, but there you go.
Brian, any great affiliations with Kerry? Any relations down here? Or have you any great memories of Kerry?
No, some memories. I remember coming here with my father many years ago. I think I was maybe 6 or 7, and we came here with a boxing team during the horse fair. It would have been with Trinity College. My father was the coach of the boxing club, and I can remember sitting around on horses. I thought I had a memory of horses coming into the hotel, but there was horses everywhere. That's where my man. There's actually a house. There's a picture in my sister's house. I'll be sitting on a horse at that time. But other than that, no close links. Been here for football reasons a few times in the last few years, but nothing else.
You mentioned your father. Of course, your father was an Irish champion boxer. He won 5 Irish titles, and he founded the Drimnagh Boxing Club. Is it from him you got your persistence and what are your memories of him, Brian?
Well, he won more than 5 Irish titles, but he also won the Golden Gloves. He had a European Championship, a bronze medal from the European Championships, and he got an award, a special medal that was minted as the most scientific boxer in Europe in 1937 after the European Championships. But I spent a lot of my childhood going around boxing clubs with my father around Dublin, small boxing clubs, and sometimes in the country and going to international stuff in the stadium and so on. But he died when I was only 14 when he died, so I didn't really get to extend their relationships beyond that much. Like myself, I suppose he was missing in action. He was working most of the day and coaching most of the nights, and we didn't see too much of him. At weekends it was the same. He worked all day Saturday, and Sunday was for boxing, for coaching. And unfortunately I didn't get to know him as well as a lot of other people did, but obviously I've read a lot about him, and I've met a lot of people who knew him very well, and he was a great influence on the family. I presume he installed the stuff, he installed basic tenets that somebody has to have as a coach or a manager or whatever, of discipline and maybe dealing with people to some way. But unfortunately I didn't get to know him well enough.
Since your appointment, Brian, 5 months ago to the Irish Republican team, how has your life changed?
For instance, you've asked me to come into this studio. You may not have asked me if I hadn't had the job. That's an indication my life has changed. It's different. I would have said that, previously maybe 10% of the population around Dublin knew me as the manager of St. Pat's and the underage teams. People recognised me, but now it's a much, much higher percentage, and people seem to at times take it upon themselves to be shouting at you in the street and running after you, and generally letting you know that they recognise you, which is a bit different. The work hasn't changed dramatically. It's much more intense because the media scrutiny of your work, but the actual extent of it and the range of it hasn't changed that much, to be honest.
You had a wonderful, successful time with the Irish youths, Brian. You brought them to European titles, brought them to World Cups, and did you like working with the youth? Was it a very, very happy time for you, and did you always want to become the Irish senior manager?
Well, you have about 5 questions in one there, Weishi. But if I try and start with the first one, did I enjoy the time with the youths? Definitely. But a lot of people, when the job was open for the senior job, seemed to think that I'd only ever worked with youth players and doubted whether I'd have the ability to work with senior players. They seem to forget that I had spent a long time working in the League of Ireland as an assistant coach, as a coach, as a manager, in all sorts of roles. And I was well familiar with working with adults rather than youths. I went back into the youth game when given the opportunity by the FAI in 1996. I did enjoy it. It was a great time. We had fairly rousing success, I think it's fair to say. Noel O'Reilly was a great part of that success. We had good players, tremendous support from the association and from clubs and leagues and teams all around Ireland, and it was the cooperation of the clubs in England that many of the players played for. But it was a great time, and I enjoyed it a lot. Had the ambitions to manage the senior team. I'd said all along that I was never over ambitious about any particular roles. I was always happy to have the role I had and to do it to the best of my ability. And we see, that's the way I've always been in football or in life. You see what comes next, and you decide whether it suits you or it doesn't suit you. And I just thought at this time that it was the right time for me. I felt it was the right time to let it be known that I was interested in the job, and that's all I did. I didn't make a big deal about it at the time. I just said I was interested in the job, just like any others probably did, and I stayed out of all the speculation after that, and I was happy enough to get the job.
Of course, you managed St. Patrick's Athletic when they won two League of Ireland titles. It was a huge time too. And what's the big difference, Brian, in managing League of Ireland players and managing Premiership players?
Well, people are people. People are the same. Players are the same. The difference in players is their ability, and the level that they play at allows them to do things faster. Sometimes they're more tactically aware, which in general the senior team players I find are, compared to the teams we had in the League of Ireland. But it's also the fact that they're all in full-time, they're full-time footballers. They get more time to rest and prepare mentally and physically for the games, compared to lads who have generally been in the League of Ireland working in the daytime. They're training three, four, five nights a week, as many of the clubs are now, and it was more difficult for them. It was difficult for me as well, because I was working. I had, a real job in the university, and that's the most obvious difference. But the senior international players are better technically in general. That's the difference.
Of course, your backroom team, of course, when you picked that was very important, of course, as you know, and your old friend Noel O'Reilly, of course, he was with you from, I suppose, since the very start of your career. And then you had Paddy Bonner and Chris Hutton, and you had our own Brian McCarthy, a man who does tremendous work down here in Kerry. Brian, what's Brian McCarthy's role exactly, you might explain to the listeners?
Well, Brian has had a wide-ranging role as a regional development officer over the last few years here. You would know of his involvement in many other areas of the game, his management and his work with Tralee Dynamos, Kingdom Boys, and the teams he's coached and the coaches he's coached over that time. He's made a major, major impact. With us, he works on the analysis side, the technical analysis of the opposition before we play teams, the viewing of matches, preparation of tapes, for individual tapes for the players, and CD-ROMs for the players after games and before games, and also, but for all the staff, he supplies us with what we need in terms of what we want to show the players before the game in relation to the opposition, or some stuff in relation to our own team. Also, he films many of the training sessions, which is allows us to review the training sessions and allows the players to review the training sessions as well. Basically, he's the one that pulls many, many things together that allow us to review and preview and to show people in advance what they're going to see when they play in the match.
And he keeps you in touch with everything that's happening in Kerry, I presume, Brian?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Brian, we've had a very close relationship since he became involved, since he began to work for the FAI first on a part-time capacity 5 years ago, must be nearly now. But since he's come full-time with us in the last couple of years, we've obviously had a lot more dealings, and he's been a very important part of the whole team and the structure. And I know in the game here, he's made the major impact for Kerry. You've only got to look at the emergence of international, not just down to Brian, I know, but he's one of the main players. They've had a dramatic change when you look at Fianna in the Youth Cup final this year, Tralee Dynamos winning the Youth Cup a few years ago, players emerging for our international team, Stephen O'Mahony, regular in our under 18, under 17 international teams, players moving on, playing the League of Ireland. It's fantastic change around for a county not traditionally seen as a stronghold of soccer, but many things are changing in life, thankfully.
Indeed. Brian, I suppose what better place to ask you about anything on about you dealing with the media than to ask you when you're on Teleshock actually talking on the media. How do you find the media since you became Irish manager? Because the media and Irish international managers, to me anyway, on the outside looking in, they had a kind of a contemptuous kind of an affair at times. How do you find the media dealing with?
Well, I've had lots of dealings with the media. When I was manager of Pats, I would have thought that they were crucial for us to have publicity and to have bigger crowds, the matches, and I understand that they have to do a job and they need information, they need to be serviced. I would have always tried to cooperate with them. As a senior team manager, it's different because the demands, the number of people that are interested in the international team is colossal. If you, I think one of the ways I could compare it for you, if you take the interest in any of the individual county teams in Gaelic and you multiply that across the board by our 26 teams, that are 26 counties involved in our senior soccer team, that's the type of media interest there is in our team. But also there's a fascinating interest from the British media in Irish affairs, the Irish team affairs, and you know, it means that there's constant demands on your time in relation, and just at times it's a bit difficult because their demands, they want information that sometimes you don't want them to have. For instance, they're always very interested in what your team is going to be for match. It doesn't necessarily suit the manager for not for the media not to have the team, for the opposition to have the team.
The Gaelic manager's Brian Rettett now, because I see John O'Mahony fielded 17 players.
I have to say, I've often wondered about the whole thing of Gaelic teams being selected so early in the week and published to teams, because I can't understand how they're so certain about it so early in the week so often. Now, I've always found that every team I've managed, there's always decisions that you feel the longer you go on thinking about them and judging them and so on, that you're more likely to make a better and more precise decision the longer you spend at it, and that sometimes you're better off not being rushed by anyone else's demands. Just go by what you feel yourself. And also, with regard to the opposition, I mean, I know I feel very comfortable. I know what the opposition's team is going to be before the match, because I can plan to deal with them tactically. Mm-hmm. Some people might say, well, it's very obvious what their team is going to be. It shouldn't make much difference. But small things do make a difference. Small things do make a difference in the winning and losing. But I like to think I have a good relationship with them, and they're able to retain a good relationship with them. I understand their demands. They understand my work, and I've explained that to them from the start. I need space and time to work, which the fact that I'm in Ireland, I'm more accessible to people, which makes it more difficult, whereas the previous couple of managers we've had have lived in England, and they haven't had those demands on them, except from the English media, who are obviously more concerned about the English team. But for me, in here, everybody wants a bit of it.
You took over, Brian, at the time when the right-wing thing, the Saipan, was gone on. No, I'm not going to be raking up all who's right or who's wrong, but the whole country were up in arms and it got fierce. What did we learn, if anything, out of the whole thing that time?
I think we learned that everybody in the country thought they were an expert on it.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody.
Were you surprised with the amount of publicity that the whole thing got, Brian?
I suppose I was disappointed more than surprised. I was disappointed because it was such an issue. I understand how the preparations were done for the World Cup, and you know, there's been comparisons made to preparations with the preparation of some county teams and stuff. And I thought that was outrageous stuff. There's no comparison with having to go halfway around the world with so many people, and there's so many angles on the time changes and the preparation of players and the matches, from the fact that you're going to be playing in the heat. There's no comparison between having a month between the matches here and getting ready for Pro Park. It was ludicrous to be talking that way. But however, I was sad from everybody's point of view about how that situation arose and how it went on. Really, no one as a football manager, what it's like, as many people would know, as at the lowest levels. It was so sad, having put so much into the qualification, getting through the toughest group with Portugal and Holland, and then to end up in the pre-match stage, which can often be a lovely, vibrant, calm time, you know, that it was so different. I felt very sorry for everybody involved in it, that's really. Yeah. But I thought the discussion around the country was generally mad stuff, that everybody became such an expert and everybody seemed to be a psychologist and a professional psychologist.
It was unbelievable.
The reality is that none of them have a bloody clue in most cases where the ball is pumped or stuffed, and yet they were an expert on how the whole situation should be handled. It was just, you know, it was a very, very complex situation, difficult situation, and the time difference didn't help, and the number of people who interfered. You know, there, but for the grace of God, go I and lots of other people. I'm glad I wasn't in it. I remember at the time going to meet Liam Toohey, whose wife had just died, unfortunately, And we were speaking about it at the time and saying, God, you know, wouldn't it have been terrible for any of us to be involved in the middle of it? You know, it was a terrible situation. But we've all moved on. The team played well in the World Cup. The team played some great stuff. Probably didn't get the result they deserved, maybe against Spain. But there you go. That's the least. We were there, and the team played well, and the supporters support for the team. The team played well in a different way than maybe previous World Cups. The image of the team and the country and the style was the thing. What was that really? I think people around the world looked at us in a different light after the World Cup. They looked at how the situation was dealt with before I came, but they also looked at how the team performed, the style they played with, which was a lovely cultured style of football, with the individual brilliance of the two young lads of Robbie and Damien. So it was, whereas in previous World Cups we had an image of being a long ball team that smacked it around the pitch and used the big man and used our physical presence. That's changed now, and for the better, I think.
What's your concept of football, Brian? How do you like it being played?
I like it being played that we win.
and dealing with players, like, what's your approach to dealing with people and players?
I'd like to think I have a sensible approach in this, but there's nothing special about my approach. I think I'm prepared to work with a team. I've got a team of staff around me that you mentioned earlier. They're brilliant people. They're very, very committed. They're very Irish in their ways. They're from across the spectrum of the Irishness, let's say, with Chris's mother being from Limerick, and he's black. We've got Paddy, who went to school in Donegal until he was 17 and spent all his life at one club. We've got Noel O'Reilly, who worked also in a real job in a school for the blind in Drumcondra until very, very recently, and worked, as he says, he worked full-time in football all his life, except he never got paid for it. Brian McCarthy, another lad, Adam Bucks, who is a South African who's been here since he's been a young man. And, you know, we've got a great team of staff who are very committed. And I think for most managers or coaches, it's the ability to be able to work with people, work with a team, try and make the best decisions, but also be aware of other people's needs and requirements and what helps to make them tick, and be prepared to listen to them and move it along, and you know, and pay respect where it's due, where people have done the job, to say, you know, you did the job and you, it was a job well done. I think that's most important. But if you haven't got energy and enthusiasm, like every job, the job you're doing, the job's been done by most people on an average day in Ireland, millions of people doing a great job. If you don't do it with energy and enthusiasm, you've no chance. I think all the best coaches have that.
Brian, one thing that always comes up when I'm discussing soccer or GAA or basketball or anything is that the National Stadium, really, for soccer in Ireland, they play all their home matches in Lansdowne Road. I was talking to John Delaney lately there. Now he's hoping that down the road that we'll have, that the soccer will have their own stadium. How important would it be for the soccer in Ireland to have its own stadium? And, as you say, I throw in the second question, where does Croke Park come into that, in your view?
Well, how important, we haven't had our own stadium, but lots of countries don't play in what's the stadium of the association. Lots of countries play in stadiums that belong to the ground, belong to teams. If you think of Germany playing in Munich in the Olympic Stadium, and in England, how they've gone to a situation, they're playing in club grounds, but you think in Scotland, it's owned by Queen's Park, and so on. In Holland, they play in the Ajax Stadium, or they play in Rotterdam in the Feyenoord Stadium. So it is not necessary that the association owns its own stadium. But you have to wonder about the overall thing. If we're trying to get to a situation of having another stadium, do we need another stadium in Dublin? When we have stadium, we do need another stadium that's going to hold 40,000 or 50,000. Lansdowne Road has had its day. It's still a great stadium in terms of its winning matches and atmosphere, and the fact that it's in the centre of town. I would have loved to see a stadium built so that we don't have to be always compromising on seats and the number of seats we're going to have. We're down to a situation for the next World Cup qualification that we're going to have just over 20,000 seats available. Now, that doesn't make economic sense for us, and it doesn't help to, won't help to generate the atmosphere we need to get over our shortcomings to win matches against top opposition. We need to have a packed stadium behind both goals, plenty of, I won't say intimidation, but plenty of passion in the ground. It doesn't appear like that's going to happen in the next couple of years, and that's something urgent happens. But I hope we're going to get another stadium that we can play our games in, that we can be proud of. But Lansdowne Road really has seen us there. The dressing room accommodation needs improvement dramatically there for international football. It's not good enough. The pitch, we're sharing the rugby. To me, there's too often we're compromising on the rugby. There's rugby matches, club matches, all sorts of stuff, and you're hoping that the pitch is going to be good enough. Thankfully, for the last two games, it was in great shape. There'd been nearly a three-week break since the European Cup finals in the rugby, but it shouldn't be like that. It should be an equal sharing if we're sharing a place, and it should be on the basis of an equal footing. Understanding of the game, of the international game, should have a lofty standing ahead of club rugby matches or club whatever. Pro Park, it's not for me to say what should happen. As I've said recently, I played in Croke Park as a kid a couple of times. I've gone to Croke Park, you know, as a kid. I would have shared between Croke Park, Richmond Park and Dalymount Park every Sunday watching games. I was there last Sunday for the hurling with Wexford and Kilkenny. Fantastic stadium, built with resources, the GAA's own resources and the hard work and the vision of the people who made those decisions. Down the road, I hope. I mean, the reality is that people who are involved in sport in Ireland, the majority of people who are wise, I think, understand that in this day and age, sport is for everyone and everyone should be available. Most of the great sportsmen in Ireland have a shared vision of sport. They delight in the victories of our soccer team, our Gaelic teams, our rugby teams, our athletics, our best athletes. They don't pick and choose. The great players of the past, if we talk about Kerry, we talk about Dublin, I think they could have played a high standard soccer match against each other the week after they played those brilliant matches through the 70s, the Pats Balans and the Jimmy Keaney and the Brian Mullins area. They were all handy soccer players. They all took time out and played soccer. Many of them played junior soccer in Dublin, many of them played junior soccer in Kerry. And I think if you look deeply at it and scratch the surface of people around the country, that's the attitude they would like to have, that, you know, we should, if the will is there to have shared facilities, so be it. But, I can't understand the idea that such a marvellous facility shouldn't be shown to the world, and that people wouldn't understand what it would be like for everybody to go and watch an Irish team playing in that brilliant stadium and understand. I think at the Special Olympics, the night I was there, the opening ceremony, the 80,000 people there, with a shared focus of goodwill towards those really, really special athletes and their carers and their coaches. And that shared atmosphere that was there, I thought about it and I said, God, imagine if you had that towards any of our international teams. I mean, the GAA, to some degree, have had it recently in the Australian rules thing, or whatever they call it, the international rules thing, the make-you-up game, as I kind of refer to it as time, because there is a make-you-up game. But it was great, and I've watched the games from Australia, and I've watched them in Dublin with great interest. But it generated a passion for the people of the international flavour. But, you know, there's I'd love to see it moving on, but it's not our, it's the people of the GAA, it's their call, really, on where that goes. But we've got to do our own thing as well.
Brian, I know you're in the rush and I won't delay you much longer, but your passion and your enthusiasm is captivating, I must say that. And you mentioned the Special Olympics, I won't delay you long more now. You mentioned the Special Olympics and you were involved in the Special Olympics. I was involved myself locally in the Special Olympics. A wonderful time for the country. Now, what legacy will it leave? And will it leave a legacy? Are we inclined to forget things?
Well, we are inclined to forget things. I've been doing bits and pieces, but not enough for those involved with working with those special people and special children. And I think what it brought home to us all was that there were so many people that needed care and attention and support and that you could get so much back from it if you gave a bit. And it's been interesting in the last few years where I've worked with our regional development officers and encouraged them to give time to people working in that area of sport, and they've always said to me they get much more pleasure from it than any other work that they do. Now I hope the legacy will be that, one, the government will continue to invest money in helping the people who work with them in the special schools and the carers and facilities that are required for them to have a decent life. I hope the people who got involved in the Special Olympics. Don't forget the joy, and but also that it's an everyday thing, that it's not something that you can parcel up for 2 weeks in the summer of 2003 and walk away and think that's the end of it. That's enough. That's not enough, because the people who, their families have to live with those people every day, and the difficulties they have. I know that the people have said, but you look at the positive side and look at the great potential they have. That's okay, but they need facilities, they need time, they need grounds to use, they need dressing rooms to be available, they need halls to be made available, not to be stuck with a red tape or stuck with a fee to get that hall open. They need a ramp to get those wheelchairs into those facilities.
What can our listeners do, Brian?
I think our listeners can say, look at, you know, why should I sit in the house one or two nights a week reading papers, reading books and watching fairly stupid soaps on the telly most of the time? Why don't I go out and offer myself to a group and work with them and be prepared to help out with somebody who's helping already, or to be a coach or a carer or a driver or anything with the various organisations that are doing unbelievable work. And I think until the Special Olympics were held, unnoticed work and unheralded work and unsupported work in many ways, you know. And I think it's made everybody aware that there are more responsibility on us than just doing what are often easy tasks and working with particularly able-bodied people all the time. There's a responsibility, and we are a caring society in many ways, but in recent years with the Celtic Tiger and all that, I think we've become less caring, and I hope it's struck a long-lasting emotional chord with people, that they take up responsibility. They say, maybe we can do a little bit more and make their lives more enjoyable, because you certainly get it back. I had a great week going around watching the events, all the events. I watched 4 days, the football, but I also went to the athletics and the swimming and the table tennis and the gymnastics, and I enjoyed it, but it was more than anything, it was the fun I got back from the people and the laughter and the sense of achievement that they had. And you know, it was so easy to get a laugh, it was so easy to get enjoyment, and there was none of the backbiting and bickering and let's say back knifing that we often get in sport at times in Ireland, where people are competing for the same bit of space, or they're competing for the same players, or they're competing for the similar resources. There was none of that. There was just total goodwill and give.
It just struck me, the difference between that and between the right-wing controversy. The difference in the country.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Well, it's probably amazing to think that it was a similar time a year later, but, you know, they were both very passionate times. Some of it was down to individual, but there was just this whole sense of, all right, well, I thought with the goodwill at the Special Olympics, that people were able to accept defeat so readily and to take joy out of the fact that they participated. And I said to so many of our own coaches as I went around, imagine if we could turn this style of approach into our everyday sport here, where what we have in comparison to that is we have parents behaving like absolute headbangers on the touchline every day, every weekend, watching their underage kids playing sport and demanding professional standards of them and abusing them if they don't perform to the highest standards that they expect of them, instead of nurturing, instead of appreciating that they give their best. That no kid goes out on any pitch not trying to do their best. And you know the old phrase, Mother and Olga's chucky shit, you have to praise them, you have to give them. But we have it across the board in every sport, it's not specific to soccer or GAA or any other sport, it's across the board. We have this madness about us on the touchline, and I feel it's disgraceful behaviour in general. It's time we stood back and had a bit of a look at ourselves and look at how the coaches and how the people behaved during the games. I'll tell you one story that struck with me particularly was I went to the basketball, and Ireland's second team were playing in the basketball. I think it was against Austria, and they were losing by 40 points, and the stadium basketball arena up near me in Tala was full, and the place was hopping with the support of the team, and Ireland got a couple of baskets, and the crowd went demented. It was as if they'd won the World Championships in basketball, and the score was irrelevant. At the end of the game, the score was irrelevant. The team were cheered off the pitch, and I said, God, compare that to how we generally behave towards our underage sport, and how many more of them would stay in the sport if we behaved like that? Because, you know, you know, we talk about big dropout, right? Big dropout figures, high dropout figures in modern sport, and we wonder why. And we wonder why we have a huge problem with underage drinking. It has been discovered in surveys. The main reason why people drop out is the over-competitive nature of the games and the demands of the people on them. The demands on the win-win-win factor. That is the chief reason. The other one is that they just don't enjoy it. Now, I would say, how can you enjoy it if most people are giving you stick if you make any mistake?
And what would you say to parents listening to you tonight, now, Brent?
I would say to parents that they should reevaluate their approach. They should think about themselves as when they were kids. What inspired them and what did they enjoy? And I'm sure they enjoyed someone coming to them saying, you did great, fair play to you. Because that's what I remember. I can remember distinctly the managers and coaches I played for. And I particularly remember the ones who were nice to me when I was a kid. But I mean, in the Gaelic, in terms of Gaelic football, I think of the teachers and the brothers in the school who encouraged us and who said positive things to us and made us think that we were and those things stand with you. But equally, I can remember the one or two who weren't nice. And if you think of kids today, you know, and the dropout rate, why did they drop out? And one of it isn't difficult to work it out. If you're overcritical of them and you keep demanding, there can be only one winner in any game, but there can only be one winner of the championship or the league at the end of any season. So does that make everyone else a failure? Of course it doesn't. Think of the Special Olympics again and the competition element of it and the joy that all the families got, the coaches got, the parents got, the whole country. And the joy, why did they get the joy? They didn't get the joy because Ireland were winning gold medals and bronze medals. We actually did grading for the football. And, you know, we put Ireland into sections where we knew they weren't going to win. We knew they were going to struggle.
Brian, you know everything about soccer, but you won't answer this question. Who were the only soccer team that got a standing ovation at a Gaelic football match? And I tell you, it was the El Salvadorian soccer team. I was involved in the three group here. And the El Salvadorian soccer team stayed here. They won the gold medal.
I saw them.
They won the gold medal in the Olympics.
I saw them. They won the day of the opening ceremony. There was football that morning. Yeah. The grading was going on the 11th side in the AOL, and I saw them and I picked them out with the winners that day.
They stayed here in Tralee Bride, and they came to the Kerry Tipperary game into the stand, and they came in 20 minutes to go. They got a standing ovation.
Well,
isn't that fabulous?
It is fabulous, but it shouldn't be unusual.
It shouldn't
be unusual that soccer teams get standing ovations in Gaelic stadiums anywhere, particularly at underage level and so on. I think we've, you know, the day has gone when we should be narrow-minded and looking at sport in from particular sport. I was taught in my house, my father played, he played hockey, which was probably an unusual one. He came from a very working class background in Belfast.
And your mother, Lachlan Messner, came from Belfast.
She did, but we were taught to be open about sport, and we were taught to be open about life. And, you know, I think that's the way it should be. I would never discourage a kid from playing hurling or football or Gaelic football or whatever he wants to play. I would say show them the game, let them have the game, let them make the decision what they want to play when they're 14 or 15.
Do you know what would be the greatest radio programme in Ireland? If you had Sean Boylan there, Brian Kerr there, and Mick O'Dwyer there. Mick O'Dwyer and Sean Boylan, and I'm deliberately raising their names, two men I've interviewed, I class you in the line. Talk to me about the two of them, Brian.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to meet both of them, usually at awards dinners, at the Texaco Awards or something like that. I've been fortunate enough to sit between them now and again, and Kevin Heffernan. I have a picture in the house with Kevin Heffernan being the other one in the picture. You can pick the odd one out even easy enough. It's a very humbling experience to sit among men like that who have achieved some. I don't know. They're just extraordinary. I saw Sean Boylan on the television after. I did the television program with Mick a couple of weeks ago in relation to our greatest sporting moments. They're just incredible people. But again, I think what comes across is their love for sport and the love for people in sport, not their love just alone for the Gaelic games that they've been involved in. I think it's they're across the board. I mean, Mick is as informed about soccer as he is about Gaelic or about Kildare or Laois or Kerry or anywhere else. He's right on the ball. Obviously, he has a huge interest in golf and athletics. He's just incredible. But Sean Boylan, fantastic man, fantastic, unbelievable. I mean, you see his Sean Boylan talking the other night. I actually thought it was very interesting when Colin O'Rourke was asked by your own man, Pat Spillane, would he go for the job if Sean gave up? He more or less said, how could anyone ever go for the job as long as Sean Boylan wants it? Respect, but it's only right. It's how they've lasted so long and kept that enthusiasm. I'd never stick it.
But you know, Brian, like, you know, they're an example really for people, yourself now and them, like, they're exemplary people, and they keep other people going. You're talking about taking jobs. Would you ever think of going across channel, doing a premiership manager?
No, I've no ambitions above the jobs I'm doing. When I'm doing the job, that's the job I want. I've never made any plans to be across channel or to work in England or anything like that. I'm quite happy in Ireland, although it's easier for me when I'm out of Ireland. At the moment it's easier mentally, and the demands are less, but I don't have any ambitions in that.
You have four daughters, Brian, and you're married with four daughters. Is it true that when they were small you brought them to a match, and the match was transferred to another pitch, you forgot about the daughters and you went to the match to the other pitch? Now I'm asking you out, is it true? And if it is, tell me the story.
That's only a vicious rumour, and as Fyodor Gudin said, it's a very derogatory remark, sir. And there's a vice versa version of that as well. There was one or two instances where I left them in place. It's all right when you go head up in the organisation of a game. But I think everybody in sport, you know, if you're into it like that, the families suffer. You know,
did you miss a lot of family life, Brian, with your involvement?
I think that you'd have to ask them rather than me. But I know that, you know, I've given a lot more time to football, to soccer particularly, than it's reasonable, I think, for any half-sane person. But that's the way, if you're dedicated to something and it matters to you, and, you know, so maybe over time people begin to appreciate that. That's the way it is. That's the way it has to be.
I like, you mentioned Liam Toohey's name earlier on there. Now, he was a man that I admired as a young lad playing. He was playing, he'd be in his area. He had a big influence in your life.
Well, Toohey was there. I always consider him as the grand master of soccer as far as I'm concerned. Like many other people, I was privileged to have time with him when I was a young man and trying to learn about the game. And I think about, you asked me about the media earlier, I often think about the media that they think they understand the game. And when I was probably 26 and 27 years of age, I thought I understood the game to some degree. But it wasn't really until you sit with someone like Toohey that you understand it. You didn't really understand the game at all, that you were only learning the game. And both Noel and myself were fortunate to be brought into Toohey's company when we were relatively young men to work with the youth international team. And it was an education, but just a brilliant man in football, inspiration to us. We still are close. We still have occasional chats. He's working away in the game and home farm still, still lending his experience to young players, new managers, new coaches. But he's just a great man, probably the greatest Irish sportsman, Irish soccer man ever.
That's why I wanted to mention his name. Joe, looking down the line now, and the only man I ever heard saying that Ireland could win the World Cup, strange enough, was Eamon Dunphy. I heard him saying that in television program. What are the chances of Ireland winning a European or a World Cup sometime, Brian? Are we a long ways away from it? Are we moving towards it? How are we rating there?
Well, you know where our rating is at the moment. We're at number 13 in the world based on our results. When you consider when the World Cup preliminary rounds start, I think we're up around 200 countries playing at the start of the competition. So that's not bad. Realistically, we shouldn't have a great chance given our numerical strength and the numbers of players we have is quite small. The pick from the pool is small, and we have some of our best players playing other sports, competing with countries that don't have Gaelic games, for instance, our national game. There's very few countries in the world that soccer isn't the main game and that every kid doesn't aspire to play on the soccer team. That's an unusual situation. It doesn't mean we can't aspire. I would have thought before we went to the World Cup in Malaysia in 1997, I wouldn't have thought that it was possible that we could have got to the stage we might win it. Really, in my heart of hearts, I would have said, we go here and we do okay. I didn't really know what to expect. We ended up in a very fine line in the final and now the final. We lost 1-0 to Argentina in the semi-final, who beat Uruguay in the final. We won the third place playoff. So that convinced me that it was possible, and we won some underage European championships. But it's still a very tough one to call, to get those extra few strides. I think we need to be blessed with the right circumstances, the right time, the right staff, players, the right players, special players at the right time, and a little bit of luck. But I mean, if you're in there, you have a chance. We've got to a World Cup quarter final. We've been at three World Cups, and we've never worse than the last 16 in three World Cups. We got to a quarter final in Italy. I think that was an amazing performance, working off the pool of players we had and the base we had. So I think we've got to think that we can try and qualify. And then when you go there, I mean, my attitude is when we go to anything, go to any match, I always think we have a chance of winning it. And when you win one, you come on, you win. And I was with Stephen O'Mahony, was in the car with me today, and he was asking me about John O'Shea, how good a player was he when he was under 16, 17, I think he was wondering where he stood himself, Stephen. And I said, John was part of a good back four. We only conceded one goal at the European Finals in six matches in 1998. And when you think that in the last three games, we played Spain, Portugal and Italy, and we beat Italy in the final 2-1. Now, I couldn't have imagined going to that tournament saying, well, we'd only concede one goal. But I did each game, we did think we might win each game before each game. But you need the collection of that to fall into place for it to go for you.
You mentioned the Italy game there, and I once again, I must say that I know you're in a rush, but we'll be finishing up now. You mentioned the Italy game winning when the youths won. I read somewhere along the line where you were bringing them to the match, and they were playing some kind of rebel songs on the bus, and you changed that to either Mozart or Chopin or something like that. Could you?
Well,
explain that.
We would have always tried to capture the mold, the mood, rather, before the game, going to the games with players. We would, Noel and myself would have always felt that, you know, there was a time when you needed people to be motivated by the mood of the staff as much as the mood of the players. That is actually true. You remind me of something I'd forgotten about. We had classical music on the bus on the way to the matches there, as we did in Cyprus with the team there. But you've also got to understand the players' tastes and what they want as well and what makes them feel comfortable. But that was kind of one of maybe getting them more relaxed and feeling we didn't need any advance. So, the rebel stuff to me is, I think we've all moved on from that. I hope we have. I think that the days of that stuff should be long past now. I think it's a new Ireland, it's a new Europe, it's a new world. Let's move on and get away from that old stuff.
Brian, the men on the ground listening to you tonight, the soccer men that's keeping the show on the road and lining the pitch.
I hope there's still a few of them here in Kerry.
Listen a minute. Not alone that, but we're exporting them to Glasgow Celtic even. We're sending them in abroad. And not alone that, you have Gary Breen, and we sent his father over to England. And he's from Beaufort back near the road near Paddy Lynch and them. So we're exporting a good few of them. But, and they're going to Glasgow Celtic, and we've lads across water and things like that.
I know each of them individually.
You do, I sure I know you do.
I meet them on the road.
But the men on the ground now that's listening to us tonight and that's keeping the show on the road, and that's working hard in small clubs, Fianna and Killarney and Listowel and down in Glenby and all. What do you say to those people?
Well, without those people, there's no end to the story. We've got to have that wide, broad base at the bottom, and every one of them matter to the senior international team. You've talked about exporting players. In the last few years, we've had, I think, six international players at underage level from Kerry. I hope they feel part of it. I started in the same way, in the same leagues, playing in the schoolboy leagues in Dublin as a schoolboy player, managing and coaching. Went my first coaching course when I was 17. I was talking to Stephen O'Mahony today. He was thinking about making a career out of football, and I said, well, I didn't get a career out of it until I was 44. I didn't get it. I worked in a normal job until I was 40. I've only been full time football. I'm on a career break from the college actually. But I say to each of them to stay at it, stick with it, keep giving your time, dedicate yourself to it, and enjoy the good days. I always say that to people who are involved with teams. Enjoy the good days, because the bad days are hard going, and there's plenty of them in football. And when you have a good day, enjoy it. Yeah. But, you know, the main thing is encourage them, encourage people, encourage the kids, and remember that as coaches and managers, you take the place of the parents now. You are an example now, in many ways, even more than the parents. Parents are busy, they're working till 7, and they get home and they're very tired, and the kids go upstairs and listen to music and play on PlayStations and so on. The coach actually, in many places, or the manager, has more time with those children than the parents have. So you're an example to them, and they look to you for their example and for encouragement. And what I said earlier, I mean true. They remember you long after they've gone from your club, if you've been good to them and you've been nice to them and you've encouraged them. They remember that long after then, whether you were a great coach or whether the team was great, you know. And some of the biggest players I get are fellas who played for me 20 years ago on teams, or managed schoolboy teams, and I see them now and they're decent fellas and they've got their own teams and players and families, and you see them and you say, God, he turned out all right. Because the area I walked in wasn't Fox Rock, it wasn't Black Rock or Fox Rock, it wasn't a lot of shillings around in Crumlin in those times, but they were good people and it just needed someone to give them a little hoosh along the way.
To be remiss of us, we didn't say about the great facilities they have in Kerry here. Mount Hawk Park up there, I must say, it's absolutely superb. Killarney Athletic, where I come from, Killarney Celtic, absolutely superb. But the facilities here in Tralee, the Mount Hawk Park pitch, and the work that has been put in by all the lads, yeah. I mean, it is a credit to them.
Yeah, fantastic facility. The pitch, I've been there at the pitch, I've been at games, it's beautiful surface, dressing rooms, clubhouse, the little stand gone in. Tremendous progress over the years. They need a few more of them around the place. They need a bit more. We need more all-weather pitches. The weather isn't always great here through the winter months for training and so on. Thankfully, the government have become more aware of their obligations in relation to that stuff and have helped the various sporting clubs to develop facilities. Because I think the things that we've been missing, without it, there would have been good training facilities for all the teams. That's been a massive one. Pitches and dressing rooms, they're the three key ones, and we can teach coaches and we can coach coaches, but we have to have places for them to work in. And you know, good coaches need a base to work in. And I mean by good coaches, not necessarily the tactical coaches. The best coaches are often the people who can keep kids playing and who push them on to the next level. Often the best coach in the club or in any setup is not the one that works with the first team, he's the one who's working developing the children.
Brian, you get tired from all the travelling around, you get tired from talking to people like me, interviewing you and throwing questions at you and going around, you're in Kerry now making presentations, you're heading off to Listowel. Physically, do you get tired?
I do, but I think I've learned how to deal with that as well. I don't, during the football season, I don't do as much travel. My travelling is back and forward with teams. When I had the youth teams, I still a lot of travelling, and then I'm back and forward to England watching matches. Other than that, I'd mostly watch games in the Dublin area, the greater Dublin area. So I don't do that much during the season. I get tired with the effort and trying to fit in a lot of things and trying to suit people. But I also know how to control it, and I know when I need time out, and I know when I have to sit down and read a bit or watch television or sleep, and I'm quite good at sleeping. When I get little chances of sleeping, I don't need a lot of time. I can take it.
Are you an emotional person?
I'm an emotional person. Of course I'm an emotional person. But the most
Are you emotional in the dressing room?
No. I don't know. I mean, I probably my emotion comes up, but I'm not one. If I had a hurl in my hand, I wouldn't be baiting her off the wall or baiting her off the bench. I would hope that I appeal to players' emotions and their desire to perform to the best of their ability within the game, and to understand their responsibility to everybody who has helped to get them to the exalted position they're in, to represent their country, to be one of the chosen few to represent your country is a very, very special honour. And I hope that I can transfer the honour that I have of being the manager, and the respect I have for that position, and the pride I have for it, that I can transfer some of that. Not that necessarily, I think I found with the players that irrespective of what their background has been, they have great pride about playing for a country. There's no doubt about that. Irrespective of the money that's been earned in the game, they do really have a pride in playing for a country. So, you know, the emotion I have about the game, I'm just so proud to be the manager of the team, going to the games. It's a fierce responsibility going to the match with the team, the crowd, the money they've spent to get there, the results. You know, it's pressure, but it's also it's a great sense of elation to feel that you have earned responsibility and earned it. It's been a hard road, a long road, and it's like those coaches you said. What do you say to them? You say, well, you know, you could start like me and scrap, and you could end up in one of maybe the 11th manager ever to manage Ireland, or the 12th or the 13th or whatever. I mean, I think
would you turn to prayer in a time of need, Brian, before a match?
Well, there has been the odd match where I've turned a prayer and I hope the final whistle went bloody quick. The suggestion that I turned a prayer when we were playing Albania, if it wasn't, you know, I can't say that, but you know, I'd understand that the God above is looking at us and looking down at us and watching what we're all doing, and would like us to do it in the best way and to use the talents we have in performing.
Tin Lizzy, Paul Brady, they tell me you follow, they tell me whoever they are, they tell me that you're fans of theirs.
There'd be a few more, you could throw in Rory
Gallagher. Throw in yourself.
Rory Gallagher. What was I listening to this morning? It's Coldplay, Mundy, particularly Irish people, The Blades.
How do you unwind,
John? John Martin would be one of my all-time favourites.
How do you unwind?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I get to music now and again. A little bit more, actually, in the last few weeks than I had done for a few months before that. But I like to go to gigs. I like to get to small gigs and see bands playing and stuff, you know. But not so easy to do it comfortably now as it gives you someone watching you.
Listen, it was a great honour and a privilege to have you on Terrace Talk, and I want to thank you for taking the time out, and to your wife and your daughters, I hope that your life goes absolutely smooth and that you have continued success. And on behalf of everybody in Kerry and on behalf of Terrace Talk, I want to thank you for coming on the programme. I want to thank our producer Mick Ryan, Tony O'Neill, who brought you in tonight, Brian McCarthy in particular, so helpful when he contacted me, and Billy Dyle, who's the chairman of the Kerry Soccer here, because they all helped me to get you in here to studio. And if I can get yourself now and Mick Dwyer and Sean Boylan in, do you know what we do?
You won't get those boys too, huh?